There's Just Something About Kansas City is brought to you in part by the generosity of our friends at the Cockrell Family Foundation. Thank you. Welcome to another episode of There's Just Something About Kansas City. And I finally made it, folks. I'm on stage, doggone it. I'm the iconic and historic Starlight Theater. The place is just incredible. Everybody knows it. Everybody's probably been here. What you might not know is they have virtually a brand new president in this young woman sitting right beside me. This is Lindsay Rood Clifford. And Lindsay and I go way back. We'll probably touch on that as well. When she was growing up, we won't tell any stories though, but congratulations to you. Just over a year now, it was April Fool's Day, 2023, and you were selected as the first woman to ever head up Starlight. That is an incredible honor and congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you so much. Yeah, first in almost 75 years, if you can believe it.
Wow. Yeah, I know. And you were no stranger to Kansas City, number one, but you were no stranger to Starlight either. You started out at the bottom. You were an intern here at one time, is that correct?
I was a summer intern. Wow. We have a paid internship program, and that's where I started 18 summers ago.
Oh, wow, that's incredible. And then you sort of, did you continue on with Starlight that point and just keep going, or did you have another job at that time as well?
I've mostly been at Starlight. I always say I had a brief sabbatical in the field where I went and worked in healthcare for about 19 months during the rollout of the Affordable Care Act. And I went, not for me. I think it's arts and culture. But mostly, yeah, almost 18 years straight here at Starlight, lots of different roles, but all the way up from summer intern to president and CEO.
Yeah, and talk about some of those roles, because I know one big one for you, and I think that really paved the way to become the president and CEO of Starlight, was your fundraising ability, which is very, very important for a standalone theater like this one. There are only two, I think, in the entire country that are still operating, that are just standalone.
That still
do an outdoor Broadway show.
Yeah. So yeah, and they're both in Missouri. So
yes, right. The other one's in St. Louis.
And the Muni in St. Louis. But yes, so my background, I started in sort of event operations and then moved into philanthropy, which was a great opportunity for me. When you love theater and music, it's pretty easy to fundraise because you're just talking to other people who love theater and music.
Right.
And I did that for a while before I had a board that was really wonderful and saying, we think it's going to be you for this next chapter for Starlight.
And were you surprised at all, or did you sort of think, well, number one, I'm sure you wanted the job. Okay. And then number two, you know, I think that's maybe what you had been working towards.
Actually, I was not just surprised, I was probably shocked. I think an institution like Starlight, with the history that it has, and certainly with its importance in Kansas City, with its legacy, I certainly anticipated that there'd be probably a national search, that there'd be a lot of people that would be in the running for a job like this. And so I was surprised to have we have a great board of directors here. It's 35 people strong. It's all of the city's corporate and civic leaders, and for them to kind of say, we have confidence in you in stewarding this place's legacy. Right. That was a surprise and an honor, and I feel that obligation daily in trying to make sure that I'm taking care of that as we move forward, because I did grow up coming here too. I'm a born and raised Kansas Cityan, so right. It's really important to me.
Yeah, and I think for them too, it's someone who knows Kansas City. It is a different part of the world. I mean, we've got our own branding now, and it is really just building and building and building. All the way back with the Royals, maybe in 14, 15, did a little, and everybody started to see this parade thing down between these two buildings that have all of a sudden just exploded with Union Station and the World War I Museum and Memorial. But then, of course, the Chiefs, then the draft, 2026, are going to have the World Cup. It has just morphed into what it is today, which is really on a positive trend right now. And I think it was important for them to stay on that trend with Starlight to make sure it was someone local who knew us, knew the people here, and knew what they really wanted and to keep going.
I think that's probably true. When we look ahead and you think of, I mean, the history of Starlight, and not everyone knows this, but Starlight was built as a Kansas City's present to itself for its 100th anniversary.
Right.
So it's kind of tied in with what it is to be a part of Kansas City. And I think you're right that Kansas City's been having this moment that's very different. If you did grow up here, you know there's something in the air this past decade.
That's right.
And so it's a really exciting time to be a part of it. And I think those of us that have grown up and seen that evolution and seen that journey probably appreciate it in a different way than people that are coming in who also, I think, feel it.
Yes.
But it's different when you've lived it and you've seen that change over time.
Yeah, right. And just to know our people and know what they want and know, you know, how they handle situations like this. Before we get into the history of Starlight, which we will, for you, as you were coming up, I'm sure you had other opportunities to go somewhere else and to do other things. Okay, you don't have to mention too many of them, but I'm sure you did because of how successful you had been, especially in fundraising here. Was there any pull or tug or to go somewhere else and to do something else and move somewhere else?
I think I knew that at least for now, I wanted to be in Kansas City. And I think part of it was feeling that energy that's happening here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's changed. I mean, having grown up here, I would say when I was in high school and college, it was sort of the norm at that time to want to get out of Kansas City, right? You thought the opportunities were elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And when I was looking at that time to go to New York, because I was referenced myself as a recovering theater kid. And I thought, well, if I'm not going to do theater, then I want to be in and around the business, which I've ended up doing.
Right.
But I really thought that meant leaving the city. And I ended up taking the paid internship here at Starlight. And it almost at the time felt like a concession, I'll do this and then see where it takes me from here. And it's the best decision I ever made. And it led to, you know, a full-time job. And I think all the time how lucky it was that I made what at the time felt like a very pragmatic, you know, early adult decision that has put me on this course that it wouldn't have been that way if I'd moved to New York and started in a mailroom of a talent agency, which was my other opportunity at the time.
Yeah, right. Oh, gosh. Yeah, mailroom talent agency. Yikes. Get lost down in the shuffle with the postage. And you went to University of Kansas, and you're an English major, I believe. And so were you into dramatic arts there as well?
I did theater and music. And like a lot of kids that do theater growing up, you kind of have a moment where you go, well, am I going to do the art? Or am I going to figure out how to have a steady paycheck? Mm-hmm. And I decided I wanted the steady paycheck. So I pivoted the time, but I did theater growing up. I did music growing up. I was a choir kid. So all of those things. And I had the privilege of doing that growing up. So it's also why it's been important to me to be a part of a nonprofit organization like Starlight, where we have that opportunity to bring that to other people who may not always have that privilege growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about Starlight. Okay, here we are. We're on stage at Starlight. I think I always talk to all my buddies who are athletes and ex-pro athletes, and all the ex-pro athletes want to be movie stars or rock and roll stars, okay? And all the rock and roll stars and stage actors, they all want to be athletes. So there's something in the DNA.
Grass is greener.
There's something in the DNA with these people. So, just incredible. This all started way back in 1925. The whole germ of the idea was when we dedicated the World War I Museum and Memorial, okay, to all the World War I vets. The president was here, Calvin Coolidge, and I think it was Queen Marie from Romania was here as well. And they put on this tremendous show outdoors for the two of them to dedicate the memorial, because obviously the memorial is outdoors. And I think the seed was planted at that time. Why don't we have an outdoor venue of some kind where we can do this sort of stuff, right? So I think that's where it started, right? But it took
25 years
to then actually begin to put this structure up, you know? So I guess it was the 100th anniversary of Kansas City that spurred everyone on to let's get this thing done. We've been talking about it for 25 years.
Well, what was interesting in 1925 is that other theater we were talking about, the Muni in St. Louis,
right.
That's when that theater was built, and it was an outdoor amphitheater. And so a lot of what Starlight was really modeled after the Muni. That's what was sort of inspired it, although Starlight has changed a lot, and the Muni in some ways has stayed the same. It's still an outdoor, open-air theater, so it's not an enclosed stage house like we have here. But really, and designed very differently. So this was designed by Edward Delk, who, of course, also did the Kansas City Plaza.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And so it's a beautiful structure that doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. So they really wanted to take what started as an idea out of St. Louis and say, but we want to do it even better.
Right. And construction started in 1949. They actually opened it before it was done in 1950, they decided to have a show in 1950 that was the first show that they ever had here. And I think it was
Thrills of a Century.
That's exactly right. And they actually, I don't know, the stage is way bigger than it used to be, okay? But they had a reenactment of the Battle of Westport on a much smaller stage. And they even brought in the first locomotive that ever went across the Hannibal Bridge, somehow got it here, put tracks down, and rolled the locomotive across the stage. How did they ever pull that off?
It's kind of amazing the things that have happened here over time that you think, I mean, and that's kind of the magic of theater too, right? You, if you can dream it, you can do it.
Right. So how did they pull that off with how'd they get the locomotive here?
Well, that's a good question. That's probably lost to history at this point. Same way we probably got a helicopter in here 25 years ago.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So the opening in there was in 1951. First Broadway production was Desert Song.
That was the first Broadway hit.
June 25th. Yeah. Oh my gosh. It's right there. It's almost another anniversary right here. So, and talk about the stage before it was, as it is now, is a permanent stage. They had to change the wood on the stage every year, didn't they? Because it was an outdoor theater.
Exposed to the elements. It was an open air theater. So all it had was the stage. And so it was just sky above, which meant that all of the sets, the scenery, everything had to be built and rolled in on carts or moved across the stage. And so it was exposed to the elements, which also meant that anytime there was a raindrop, shows had to pause or stop. So it was also kind of a riskier business at the time. And the performances that we were doing at the time was really 10 shows a year that were all sort of locally produced musical theater. Right. So that was sort of the history for the first almost 50 years.
Yeah, right. And I think that was important because they were locally produced. You know, the Broadway shows, you had the music, had the lyrics, you could get a director in who could tweak it a little bit, but you had that. But there were a lot of local actors involved, and I know there are big stars involved as well, but there are a lot of local actors involved too that would be able to hone their craft right here on this stage.
Right here in the summer, Midwest summer heat, because it was all happening outdoors. They rehearsed outdoors for just weeks in advance. So it was kind of a whole experience. A lot of people refer to it still to this day as sort of like theater summer camp because you come out and it's so different than working in other cities and in closed theaters. So there was some charm to that at the time, but it was very different and also drove ultimately why we ended up evolving the theater and enclosing it so that we could do things like national tours and bring in national acts as well.
And while we're on the subject of the stage as well, I think it was 1958, Jerry Lewis, Lewis and Martin came here, okay? Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis. He came here, he performed. And when he was done, he went to the board of directors and everybody and said, you know what? You're too far from the audience. I just feel too far from the audience. You've got to move this stage out and engage. And they listened to him. And that's exactly what they did, didn't they?
Yeah, they sure did. And I think that's kind of been the history, is great feedback from people here. And we've made the changes to make it what it needs to be for the future.
Yeah, right. And then in the 60s, of course, you're talking about you'd have 10, 9, 8 shows a year here and put on the big productions with the Broadway shows. And that was the metamorphosis of everything. And theater manager was Richard Berger. He was a very innovative guy at that time. Talk a little bit about him, about Richard Berger and what he meant to this.
He's really, when people think about Starlight and its history, I think they think about Dick Berger. That's who, we've got spaces that are named after him now, but at a time in Kansas City where there wasn't a lot of other theater and arts and culture opportunity, he really made this where theater was happening. This is the place where everyone came. This was the tradition. People used to get dressed up in suits to come out here in the summertime to see shows.
Despite the fact it was 100 degrees.
Despite the fact that it was 100 degrees. Luckily, we don't do that anymore. That's not the expectation.
Right.
But really drove with this mission at the time to say, if you can't go to New York and see Broadway, you know, musical theater on Broadway, then how do we bring Broadway to Kansas City? And he really drove that to say, this is what the Midwest deserves. This is what Kansas City deserves. High quality professional theater performances that the whole city, the whole region really can come and enjoy.
Right. And in different, one of his sayings is, a natural saying anyway, variety is the spice of life. He wanted variety on the stage too, not just, he wanted musicals that would eventually cross over all genres. Like if you liked the deep, you know, Hollywood Broadway show and heavy message or whatever, or the light musical that was a lot of fun or whatever, he wanted to do it all, didn't he?
And I think that really became the roots of what we still believe today, which is that we should be putting things on the stage that are for everybody, not for just any one audience, but that everyone can find a path to something here. And I think he really inspired that with that approach of saying variety is the most important thing. It can't be all the same thing or all the same shows or the same show every couple of years, but really saying what's going to get people interested and spark that inspiration and get people talking and get new audiences to come in and find that they love theater.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons why they had some issues in the 70s with money is because they're charging $5 for a premium ticket, $4 for normal, and then $1 if you wanted to sit back a little ways. And as you can see from this theater, there's not a bad seat in the house, okay? Is incredible. So I think a little bit of that, and he wanted to be able to open it up to all the public and not to price anybody out of it. And I think that was important as well.
That accessibility component has also been sort of connective tissue from the beginning to today, that affordability piece, having community access to the theater. But yes, along the way, we've had to evolve that because it did cause some issues. And again, when you're exposed to the elements, you have a couple bad rain days and suddenly you're having a bad financial year too.
Yeah, and so all of a sudden the Broadway plays get replaced by sort of more of a variety show type things, right? As singing acts or whatever else that you could bring to the stage here. And that ended up doing okay, I think, for a little while. And then all of a sudden it didn't work very well, did it?
There was a period in the 70s and early 80s where I think we tried some new things here that, to your point, I think worked some, didn't work all the way through, was not what people expected, and kind of put us in a situation where it was probably in the history of Starlight where we hit probably the most dire straits, where there was really the risk there a couple years of saying, will Starlight have to close its doors completely? So some scary times, and you have people today that still talk about those times of when it felt like we were at the lowest point and could you make payroll and were you going to have to close the theater up completely?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're on the brink of bankruptcy at that point, and you're still going to bring in some musical concerts and try to fend it off for as long as possible. And I think went to about just the beginning of the 80s when you're in the brink of, and then Bob Rolfe came along as a GM. Talk about Bob Rolfe.
So Bob was the director of marketing here at Starlight. And when there was a very small year-round staff, there were no offices here at the theater. They officed up at the top of the park when they were coming in. And Bob really got, in some ways, what Richard Berger got, which was that this was a place that was about and for the community. Mm-hmm. And there were some...
They had lost that a little bit.
They had lost that a little bit along the way. And I think he understood, because he was in marketing and he was a salesperson, he understood the power of a good story and that really theater and music was about good storytelling. But it was also how you got people engaged in supporting it. And he thought this was a theater that belonged to Kansas City. And that was really the story he told. And there were a few key people at the time, Shirley Helzberg being one of them, Jack Steadman being one of them, Anita Gorman being one of them, really pillars of the Kansas City community at the time, that believed in this place and believed in Bob's leadership. And Jack Steadman, as the story goes, really tapped him as director of marketing and said, you're going to run the place.
Right.
This is your opportunity. He'd never run a theater before, but he kind of had the belief of Jack Steadman and pulled up and just turned the place around with just this belief that in good storytelling, you could fill these seats with people and bring people back. Went back to sort of the roots and said, we're going to do musical, we're going to produce musicals and we're going to give the people what they want and we're going to really lean on the community to get season tickets and fill the seats. And it worked. They went between those sort of pillars of the community that also went out and made sure that they did some fundraising to keep the doors open long enough to get the seats full again. But it was really a remarkable turnaround from a low in a 70, almost 75 year history to, you know, he was here for almost 30 years. And at one point, we had 28,000 season ticket holders out here. And he was the reason why we enclosed the stage house and saw some of the most transformational capital improvements that we've seen to the facility in its history.
Yeah, and I think in this community, I think this is the other reason, there's just something about Kansas City. It's so philanthropic. I mean, there's so many people that all you really have to do, they just want to know, well, do you want us to help? All you have to do is ask. All you had to do was ask. And Jack Stebbins, of course, worked for Hunt Midwest for years and years. And Lamar Hunt, and who was very, you know, involved in the community, despite the fact he lived in Dallas, Texas. And all you have to do really for the people here, and it has been our, I think it has been woven into our DNA throughout our history, is all you have to do is ask, and people will respond. Because, you know, we're Kansas City. We're going to take care of Kansas City things.
And I think Jack understood that and did that. If you, the stories of the time, and Jack also understood, to your point about Kansas City and sports and arts. Mm-hmm. You know, he was very clearly very affiliated in the sports world through Hunt Midwest, but he also knew that places like Starlight were important to how cities like Kansas City were going to thrive.
Yeah.
And people often referred to Jack as saying, like, this was his baby here, and he wanted to see it succeed. And he also knew Kansas City, and he would just ask. He would say, this is what we need.
Yeah.
And therefore, that's how Bob learned it, too. And we would just go, this is what we need. And that's sort of been the base of fundraising. And I do think that's uniquely Kansas City.
Yeah.
I think that's something here where when you have a need, people step up and help to make it happen and really want to preserve those things that are uniquely Kansas City.
Yeah, sure. And Anita Gorman, of course, she has been woven through our fabric forever. Virtually at every point when somebody needs something, Anita Gorman is there.
The remarkable thing about Anita Gorman is she is one of just now two living lifetime board members for us. She's in her 90s, and she still shows up to almost every board meeting we have.
She's incredible.
She's incredible. I say all the time, like, that's who I want to be when I grow up.
That's exactly right, because she's never stopped.
She's never stopped.
She just continues. And then the Hellspurs, of course, have been terrific with all the way through. So 1988, all of a sudden, Starlight Theater's in the black for the first time ever due to that fundraising campaign. And then you roll into the 90s and ticket sales continue to climb. And then $5 million in capital improvements in 1993. What was in that particular $5 million that we now see today on stage here?
Well, and really that $5 million led to what was ultimately the enclosure of the stage house.
Yes, okay.
So that's at the time they were, again, looking at what's going to be the future of Starlight in Kansas City and how do we continue to expand programming from producing musicals, which we had limitations in doing because we were exposed to the elements, because we had to roll everything in and build everything ourselves. And at the time, they decided that the best thing we could do in order to make sure that we were continuing to generate the kind of revenue to support the theater was to enclose the stage house, to build out administrative offices, because originally it was just one set of towers down here and a stage, and the two sets of towers at the back with our lighting bridge. But to enclose the stage house meant we had fly space, so that meant that we could have nationally touring Broadway, which was a real opportunity for us at the time. And while we dabbled in live music up to that point, that would really also then allow us to have nationally touring acts from a live music standpoint. And that was really, I think, a turning point in saying that while the history was producing musical theater, what was really the purpose of the organization, which was live arts experiences, and to not limit ourselves by doing that either, but saying, look, this is about getting the community out to theater and music in all its potential forms.
Yeah.
So they raised over $10 million in the end to enclose the stage house, and then another $15 million just a few years later to put the administrative offices, the pergolas that you see now here, and really to bring the theater up to where it needed to be in the early 2000s to serve the community at that time.
Right, and the Garden of the Stars, of course, from the Hellsburg.
Yes.
So that's here as well, right?
Yes, and the fountain over there. There's actually a great story about that fountain, because speaking of Kansas City and stepping up, Barnett Hellsburg, as the story goes, went to Bob Rolfe and said, I want to build a fountain in honor of Shirley. And he said, and I want it to look like something that's out of, you know, Greek or Roman architecture. Mm-hmm. And Bob said, okay, what are you willing to do for that? And he goes, just tell me how much it costs.
Oh, wow.
And so he had it designed.
Sure.
And there was a figure that it started. And as I understand it, it ended up being double what that original figure started.
Of course, they always do, yeah.
And Barnett wrote one check and then wrote another check because he knew how much Shirley loved this place and really wanted to find a way to sort of honor her legacy here, and that fountain, you know, out there today looks like sort of Greek and Roman pillars over there. So we've got that to honor their legacy here.
Yeah, and
well,
if you're ever walking in Starlight, okay, and you're coming to see a show, there are stars Just like the Hollywood Walk,
Walk of Fame.
Same deal. There's stars. They're placed right there on the patio. And they are, I almost stepped on Tony Randall on my way in. Okay. Oh, I jumped aside and went, oh, gosh, I can't step on Tony Randall. But you've had the people who have come through here. It's just phenomenal. The names, although we talked about Jerry Lewis, but I mean, they're the names of the people who have appeared on this stage outdoors here in Kansas City is phenomenal.
Yeah, and you know, there was a period where that was very common. You don't see stars out doing the tours the same way you did maybe 20 years ago, but
right.
There was certainly a heyday, I think, in the 90s and early 2000s where that was much more commonplace and they got to come out here. And one of the things I love hearing all the time out here, whether it's a Broadway star or frankly some of the nationally touring music artists that we have now, is they really love this place.
Yes.
They see it and see how different it is. And they're seeing theaters all over the country, all over the world in a lot of cases. And they remember this place. And some of them will actually choose to come back here if they're out on tour and they have the opportunity to come through Kansas City because of how special they think this place is.
Yeah, it really is. And then being outdoors too.
Yes.
I think it's, you know, that's the unusual thing for them to come because there aren't
There's only
two of these, you know.
Two of these doing Broadway, and
there's
other amphitheaters doing live music. But yeah, there's something special about not, I mean, a black box theater is a black box theater.
Yes.
You go in and it's dark, and at the end of the day, that's, you know, it's kind of the same everywhere you go. But here, it is pretty iconic, and there's something about being outdoors and having the fresh air and stars above you and, you know, we're right next to the zoo, so sometimes you also get a few noise from nature, which is part of the charm.
You hear the elephant bellow over there as
but
well.
But it makes for really visceral memories. I mean, that's what I hear all the time is people describing memories that have really locked in, not just because of what they're experiencing on the stage, but because of that environment they're in as well.
So in the year 2000, okay, 50th anniversary of Starlight, and Jeanette and Jerome Cohen. Just they then took it another step, didn't they?
They made the sort of major gift that helped us to create what is now the Cohen Community Stage House.
Right.
So when we fully enclosed it, that was really due to their generosity and a very small number of donors that stepped up to help us build what is now a 10-story stage house,
right.
12,000 square feet. It's one of the largest stage houses in the country.
Right. And Broadway took notice.
Broadway took notice that
you had done this. You know, Peter Pan can now fly.
Okay,
we get Peter and Tinkerbell. They can both fly through this place. Right?
And we took full advantage. We have continued to take full advantage of that. We think about that all the time, both when we still continue to produce, but also when tours come in. That really is part of the magic of theater that we're able to do here. So it was a huge improvement. And again, when we think about the theater that we were based off of, the Muni, which has remained an open air theater, I always say part of it along the way is that Starlight really has had this history of innovation and evolving to meet the needs of today.
Yeah, and you really talk about people who take notice. You were voted a Venue of Excellence Award, best of the best. I just think that is incredible, and that's another feather in Starlight's cap, correct?
And Kansas City's.
That happened about 2010 in Kansas City's as well, right?
We're really fortunate that we tend to make a lot of the sort of national lists for outdoor amphitheaters. And the funny thing I've experienced growing up here is that sometimes we take for granted that this sits in our backyard over here. We have so many great institutions in Kansas City, and I think because it's historic, it takes sometimes hitting some of those lists for us to remind ourselves of what a gem that we do have here.
Yeah, and then Rich Baker comes on the scene, right? Talk about Rich and the impact he's had. Came in about 2010, right?
2014.
I'm sorry, right.
So Bob
with some
Rolfe,
fresh ideas.
I was gonna say, Bob Rolfe retired, and actually I started here in 2007. Bob retired in 2008, so I had the great fortune of working with him at the end of his career after his great legacy. And we had a president and CEO named Denton Yockey for 5 years, and then Rich came in 2014 and was here for almost a decade.
Mm-hmm.
And he really brought, he came from St. Louis, so he had that history of
what. Oh, we let him in?
Uh-huh, we let him in.
Okay, all right.
So he was that great example, I think, of coming to
Kansas
City.
And he knew the Muni,
City.
Right?
He did. He grew up going to the Muni. He actually ran the Fox Theater in St. Louis for 15 years. And so he brought this great perspective of an outsider coming in and seeing what a jewel this was.
Right.
And also, I think, wanting to take it to its next chapter.
Right.
He had a great history of looking at where can we continually improve the facility in smaller ways than sort of those massive transformational campaigns, although he did end up being the reason that we've launched a massive transformational campaign. And he also wanted to make this a year-round theater environment. So again, 12,000 square feet, climate-controlled stage house. he said, well, why are we just not doing anything in the winter months? So he helped us launch what was sort of an indoor series. We invested in a 466-seat riser setup for the indoor. So we basically turned the stage house into a smaller theater that we used in the winter months between October and April.
I saw Winona Judd.
Ah, yeah.
Yes, in the indoor theater, which was just incredible.
It's a really neat environment.
Right in the middle of winter.
Yeah, really neat environment. Although when we first launched it, it was funny because people would come out for a show in January and they'd have blankets like they thought they were going to be sitting out in the seats. And I thought those folks were troopers if they thought that's what they were signing up for.
They are true Kansas Citians. They're probably also Chiefs fans. Okay.
That there is a remarkable out here too, even in the summer, you know, rain or shine, right? And except for a thunderstorm, the show must go on. But longtime Starlight attendees, they are prepared with their ponchos when there's rain, and they will stay in those seats. It takes a lot, but it is a hearty group, Kansas City.
They're a hearty group. And, of course, I think with Rich Baker, he had some fresh ideas. Talk about the camps, okay? To talk about the camps that he sort of initiated a little bit. I think they were they acting camps? Were they camps for people to come and try to hone their craft?
Yeah, so we actually in the early 2000s, through one of our last capital campaigns, we launched a whole portfolio of community engagement programs.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so we had, part of those were camps where we'd partnered with the zoo for one, where we had an act like an animal camp where they'd spend half a day here learning about dancing and acting and singing, and then they'd go over and spend half a day at the zoo, which was a lot of fun and a good way to get young people out into the park. But also we really saw a lot of growth of those programs that started that were really committed to arts access. How are we getting people that may not have the means to participate in arts training? How can we provide that? How can we connect them into the arts training through funding? And really also expanding what has turned out to be our largest program, which is a high school musical theater program.
Yes.
Our Blue Star Awards, which this year had 58 area high schools that participated in it. And we send two of those students from our local program to New York for the National High School Musical Theater Awards. So he was really committed to seeing the growth of those programs, and I think growing the awareness around those programs so that people knew that it's not just what's happening on the stage, because there's a lot of great theaters and places you can see music and theater, but really what's happening behind the stage and off the stage to connect young people and audiences that might not otherwise experience theater and music into an opportunity to see
it. Yeah, right. We have a lot of talent here. There's a lot of talent. I mean, you just look at the big slick that comes through town, and you just look at all those people who are involved. You know, you got Jason Sudeikis and Rob Riggle and, you know, Heidi Gardner and, you know, Eric Stone Street, the whole crew, you know, Paul Rudd, that whole crew, Keckner, that whole, and they're all from here.
Yeah.
You know, and they all come back.
It's a talent breeding ground.
It's unbelievable. I would have no idea how you'd pick two out of all those high schools, area high schools, to go to New York.
It's really hard. But we also see then when those students get to go to New York, we had this great story just a couple of years ago during the pandemic of all things, when things were so strange. But we had a student.
The only year this was shut down, 2020.
Yeah. Yep. That's the only year that we did not have any shows on our stage since its inception. But we continued our programs during that year. We took them all virtual like everyone did, including our Blue Star Awards program. And one of the students that went on to the Jimmy Awards, the National High School Musical Theater Awards, he ended up getting kind of plucked right out of that into an off-Broadway production that went into a Broadway production. And at not quite 20 years old this last year, he was in what ended up being the Tony Award-winning Best Musical of the Year, Kimberly Akimbo. And he was a student from Olathe East High School. That is how he was discovered. So, I mean, it was an amazing story of opportunity.
Incredible. That's just incredible.
So we do have some amazing talent out of here.
Yeah, we do. And talk a little bit about the Ovation Museum.
So when actually as we were, Rich's vision for the theater was how can we also preserve the history of the theater? We had archives here, but they were frankly sitting in a closet. So he really wanted to showcase that. So we had a gift shop that used to be here that we ended up converting into sort of a museum space. We now use that space as an event space, but it's all the history that's of the theater that's sort of around it from that 1950s and its inception, highlights the pillars of the community. It's really our way of letting people go in and feel surrounded by that history. So now we use it as a space for during shows. We gather our, that's our donor lounge, or it's where we kind of do private events in there. Yeah. But to surround them with that history, because we sort of forget being out here that there's people that, I mean, the number of hands that go up when I ask about first time visitors on shows still shocks me. Because you think, yes, everyone's been here, but there's still a lot of Kansas Cityans that haven't made that first trip out here yet.
Yeah, right. And there was a time when you couldn't eat here.
Okay,
you know,
right.
you just come in and say, well, is there something to eat? No, there isn't. But that has morphed into,
that
availability
is,
for hospitality as well. Right?
Yes, and that's actually, as we look to the future, that's one of the greatest areas, I think, of growth that we see, because people really expect that.
Understand
from a trend standpoint. People want to come out, and it's an advantage we have because we have so much space here. A lot of theaters, Broadway, other just small theaters, they're small, right? You're in sort of a cramped space. You're running into the show. There's not a lot of pre-show dining or beverage opportunity. But out here in the park and just the nature of Starlight, we've got a lot of space. So what we really lean into is we want you to come out and be able to have a meal before you see a show, walk around, view the space before you have to sit down. So that's something as we look ahead, we want to create more opportunities to do at all levels, from a restaurant to maybe a picnic. So
all you need is a tailgate parking lot.
That's
the only thing
that's
you need.
Right.
You need some concrete and a couple white lines, the whole deal, you've got it, right? Because all these people here are probably the vast majority of Chiefs fans, and they're so used to
pro tailgaters.
Just cooking outdoors, exactly. For you, Lindsay, going back to your entire history here, can you remember any notable performances or people that you have met that just sort of took you back to just things that really stand out for you as far as memories are concerned? I know you have thousands of memories of this place.
I always, my very first memory coming out here, so my grandparents were season ticket holders back when it was still an open-air theater, when you came in from the very top. And the very first show I remember coming out here to was Annie. So classic Broadway, but I think they picked it because, of course, I was a little redheaded kid, and they thought Annie is the right
perfect
first musical for a little redheaded kid.
You're perfect for the lead role at that point.
But I think about now, that you talk about a lot about how seeing yourself on stage matters when you're young. And it did. I mean, at that time, it was so striking to see young people also in a show performing. How talented they were, and it was sort of inspirational. And the music, particularly out here, and there's songs in that show, and I still talk about this with shows today, where the music just floats out over the towers into the night sky in a way that does not happen in other theaters. And it is magical. Mm-hmm. And I just remember, and I was probably 5 or 6 years old, just thinking that this was like the most magical place. And it looks like a castle too. Mm-hmm. So when you're little, you think you're somewhere that's just out of a fairy tale. And to watch young people now come in and still see that, you can see it on their faces. Those are the things that stick with me the most, are those shows where you can see. I enjoy watching the audience now more than even the shows, because you can see how it's capturing them and what they're reacting to. So those are the things that stick with me.
Yeah, and just remember too, it is a family-oriented theater. So, kids and everybody, you want them to be here, and then they'll be the next generation to bring their kids and the whole thing, the big circle of life.
Yeah. That's kind of the history. And I think, a lot, we say that a lot. It's a come as you are theater, because it's outside, because you can get up. And if you need to, if you've got little people with you, you can walk around pretty easily in a way that in some other theaters, that's a little more difficult, or other spaces can be a little more intimidating. But I think that's kind of our place in the ecosystem. Yeah. I want this to be a place where people start. And then, when you have young people and when you have grandkids, that this is a place you want to come back to with them too.
Okay, challenges moving forward as you've taken over now. You are the boss, okay? It's on you now, Lindsay. So just the challenges as you move forward in this day and age with this theater.
I think for anybody that was in the arts and culture space, the pandemic was, I often refer to it as, it was like a snow globe shake. Like, we shook everything up and we haven't quite fully seen where all everything's going to resettle. And you can't go back to the before times and say that data still counts or people's proclivities then still count. So I think the biggest challenge is figuring out where are we today and what do audiences want today.
Right.
And is what they want today forever, or are they going to want something? Is this a chapter? Because right. I think what we know is that coming on the other side of no shows and no theater and that really weird period of history for all of us is that what people want and expect out of theater and music right now is joy and escape and fun. And what they're a little less open to are maybe shows that have harder material or challenge us. Right. Because the world is hard enough, right?
Yes,
that's
it
what
is,
that's what we hear. Life the world is hard enough. Mm-hmm. I want to come here and have a great time and be moved in a way that's really positive. And we're a little more risk averse when I think it comes to performances than we were before. So if I think of a challenge from a performance side, it's just when do we get to see people embrace that adventure again of what new theater is and be open to seeing something new and different. We like what feels a little nostalgic right now or familiar. And you see that in the types of shows that are successful. And especially for theater, I think we've got an interesting balance here because of live music and theater. Mm-hmm. Live music came roaring back after the pandemic. So live music here has been very successful. Mm-hmm. And theater, I think, has struggled more to say, what do we want from theater? And what is that going to look like? And what are the maybe correlations between the two? And I think part of it is live music, it's interactive, right? We're a part of it. We sing along.
Stand and sing.
Now we dress up. I mean, we're really a part of it in a way that I think is an expectation of future audiences. And in theater, history says we're just a witness.
Yeah.
But the shows that I see most successful are the ones that people do get to dress up for, or, you know, we've got The Little Mermaid coming this summer and we're going to see lots of little Ariels out here and little princesses. And there's something to that, that as we look ahead, we've got to figure out what do audiences want from theater. And then I think the bigger challenge, too, is as we sit out here on a beautiful summer day, is we're an outdoor theater. So there's always also how do people feel about the outdoor theater experience and the adventure of that and the risk of that, right? Because you don't always know what Mother Nature's going to do. Now, I always say it's high risk, high reward, a perfect night out here. There's nothing better. But getting people to really embrace that's one of the things that makes this different and special and come out. And also on our end, what are we going to continue to do to the theater to make sure that we can, to the best of our ability, preserve what the experience is no matter what Mother Nature decides to do, which is a tall order. But we try to do it. I mean, we've got fans out here now that we didn't have 10 years ago that help with cooling the place down on a hot day.
I mean, they're just silent.
They're amazing. They just give you a nice breeze.
I know. That's just perfect. But I think everybody just wants to sing along, whether it's a concert or whether it is a musical.
Yes.
They want to know the music.
That's a big deal. Yeah, there's a familiarity to it.
Right. And it brings back memories for all of them.
You know what I mean?
So there are the challenges. Just you talk to me about what Kansas City means to you. This is our little podcast here. There's just something about Kansas City. You tell me what Kansas City overall, not just Starlight, but what Kansas City means to you.
I think Kansas City to me, and I've now traveled to a lot of different cities, and I think what is so special about this place is our pride in who we are. And not just the pride, and I think pride sometimes gets a bad rap, but it's there's almost an obligation that we feel to making this place the best that it can be, and that the people are the nicest people you meet, and that what we do is the best that we can put forward. Mm-hmm. And you don't, you know, I think people joke sometimes that we're the city that wears our own t-shirts, right? Like we're our own tourists.
Yeah, we are.
But
I love KC.
But I think that's special because that speaks to that pride we feel. And again, having grown up here and knowing that, again, there was a point in my life where I thought, to be successful or to live a full life, I had to leave, to now feel so the opposite of that and feel this great sense of pride about when people come here and get to discover when maybe they had a preconceived notion about it in a different way. I feel an immense pride about that too. And I think the people here and the community and the way that we stand up for one another and the way that we want people, if we've enjoyed something good, we want to share that. That, I think, is so unique. That extension of that spirit of generosity is, I think, very unique. That spirit of community, of not just walking by someone on the street, but looking up and smiling and saying hello. That's commonplace here, but I think it's unique when you go to other places where you're less connected or you're only connected in small circles. I think we are expansive about saying if there's a way to make the circle wider, we will.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great. Thank you so much. You made me a star. I get to be on the starlight stage, right? And I just thank you so much for that, Lindsay, and continued good luck. Didn't tell one story about you growing up in Morse Village, okay, with my kids, because then I'd have to, you know, indict myself and all my children as well. But thanks so much. Congratulations on being the president and CEO and the first woman to do it. I just think that is special.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. So just keep it going, okay?
All right.
Lindsay Rood Clifford, president and CEO of Starlight. And folks, as we always say, with this iconic building here, there's just something about Kansas City. Today's episode is brought to you in part by the generosity of our friends at the Cockrell Family Foundation. Thank you.